The following is an encore episode of Convergence with Michelle McAloon and Ellen Taylor. On this episode, Ellen and Michelle talked with Richard Barris about election integrity. We hope you enjoy.
Good morning and welcome to Convergence. I'm Ellen Taylor along with Michelle McAloon. We talk about issues of faith and culture, as you know. And Michelle had a bit of a rant last week from her draconian lockdown in Germany. You feeling better this week, Michelle?
A little calmer. Still locked down.
Still going strong. We're glad you're holding it together. When we bring in guests, we kind of look at the big picture, what people of goodwill and faith can do together to make our world a better place, in essence. I came across somebody who I stumbled across is him in the media world back during the summer when he was talking a lot about people in polling, and he comes from a smart place of data. On the internet, he's known as the People's Pundit, so we welcome in Richard Barris. Welcome, Rich. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I'm so happy to be here.
One of the things that we see a lot of problems in the world and we talk about them on the show. And one of the things that really is, this has been so contentious, 2020 going into 2021. And you've got some great ideas just from the experience you've had in polling and seeing people and talking to the about solutions too. So we'll get into that a little bit, but maybe you could share with our audience what you do and how you use data to really see people.
Sure. So I mean, it's fair to say I'm a pollster, I would say, but you know, we like to think of it a lot as so much more than that. It's a different time than it used to be. Gone are the days of, old man Gallup, who used to, you know, call everybody on a phone. Things are just much different and much more complicated. And what we're really trying to do is go back to the time when Gallup began, and they would, you know, face to face almost, and we're not doing it face to face, but really keep those kinds of close relationships and close discussions when you're conducting public opinion research, where Gallup used to go door to door and they would poll people, almost face to face. And then we lost that along the way. We started using the phone. And then over time, as more and more people, one, abandoned landlines, and two, got more skeptical towards answering the phone, we really had to evolve. And we really had to change how we do things entirely. And we're seeing a lot of big major media misses, university polling misses. And it's becoming where I think my industry is now at a crisis point. And then also, of course, I mean, I'm a data journalist, and we still do. We just didn't do it this year. But the election projection model on PPD, that's really how we gain some notoriety. But just having more accurate forecasts. But really, the gist of it is, you know, trying to keep a accurate and tight, close-knit relationship with voters and their vote and voter sentiment.
I tell you, Rich, one of the things that's really impressed me about the work that you do is that numbers equal the truth, and numbers are numbers, but in the end, numbers tell the story of people. And that has really, but what you have brought to the forefront during this last election cycle. And Ellen, who's followed you actually more closely than I have, gave me a great description of your work within the Hispanic community, that actually you showed a reality that the Hispanic community is not a voting bloc the same way that women are not a voting bloc, or that men are not a voting bloc, or white people are not a voting bloc, that our individuality actually lies in the truth in who we are.
That's a great way to put it. I always say data don't lie. People do, right? And of course, there are ways that you can have people manipulate data out there. But when we do, and we're inaccurate with what I do, it does a disservice to people, because you're supposed to be, or you claim or purport to be, representing the feelings, the opinions of people. And when we poll people and we're talking to people, we're asking them about their lives, right? And we're asking them about what they think is best for them and their families. So it really does an incredible disservice when you put them all in a box or oversimplify their opinions. And this time around, it was very clear that, and the media tend to do this a lot, they really lag behind the curve. They do. And not that Hispanics ever were monolithic, right? But they always talked about them like they were. The suburban woman, very complicated voter. It's not as simple as the media made it out to be. And with Hispanics in particular this year, it was really fascinating. It should have got a lot more attention than it did. But, you know, Hispanics were very different from Florida to Texas to Nevada to Arizona. We saw them vote in ways that most pundits 2, 4, 6 years ago would have said was impossible. West Texas, his Mexican Americans, they are the reason Joe Biden could not carry the state of Texas. And yet we hardly hear about that. It's an incredible story.
It's so true, because I joked, I was down in South Florida last July and I came back to Alabama and I said, they're not going to vote in Miami like they used to. And I particularly heard it with the Colombians. They had kind of been, you know, with the liberation theology and Jesuit training, they had a certain openness to some of the Democratic leanings. And that was not there when I was there in July before the election. And then it came to pass, and you were talking about that late summer and fall. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say Colombians, and then there were new arrivals with the Venezuelan voters who really had been arriving for a while, but they became more eligible to vote, and those arrivals ramped up under Donald Trump because of the Maduro regime. And the Colombians and Venezuelans really took up communities right next to Cuban Americans, who for a while had been a reliable Republican voting bloc, but then didn't really like Mitt Romney. They basically split their vote between Barack Obama and Mitt Romney, but Barack Obama went in another direction. And we had been screaming about the importance of asking a Latino detail question in Florida for years. And, you know, not to give away all the trade secrets, but
right.
We were pretty open telling other pollsters in the media, this is one of the reasons why you cannot poll Florida, why you keep embarrassing yourselves. A Hispanic in Florida in the I-4 corridor is not the same as a Hispanic in South Florida, in Miami, in Palm, right? So, you know, it just was right there. If you really looked, it was right there all along. And you saw these massive shifts among the Hispanic community and even Cubans who supported Donald Trump in 2016. Those margins began to widen to 20, 30 points. And it started to bring his level in Miami-Dade specifically. When we were polling it, I wouldn't have believed it if we didn't track it so much in depth and in such detail, because we did see it as it was happening.
You know, just speaking about regional and leanings and where things are headed, we in Lower Alabama here are right next door to Georgia. And so we saw a very different Georgia in this electorate. And we kind of see, big picture wise, was a large metropolitan area dominating the leanings of a red state. And we're seeing that to some extent in Tennessee, let's say, with the rise of the Nashville market. Do you have any thoughts about Alabama, for example, where many of our listeners are, and is that kind of trend going to spread throughout the South?
I think that there are other Southern states where Democrats in the, you know, not short term, but mid to longer term could see some gains. Tennessee, you named it. There is, especially if we keep the mail-in voting going, by the way. I think that has to be addressed. But take a district like Georgia 7, which is in northern Georgia, and it goes through, you know, that Atlanta metro area, and then basically stops short right before you get back into red northern Georgia. And what they have been doing as a base, it's a model, and Republicans fall into it because Republicans see themselves as the party of business, and they want to be business friendly. So they bring all of these professional class firms into their states, and then tout the job creation numbers from those companies, which, you know, may be good for industry, but in the long run, when you are building up an economy that relies on liberal art degrees and science degrees and tech industry people, you're going to make your state blue. And that is what happened in Georgia. It's not just Fulton County, outside in Gwinnett, DeKalb especially, and even farther north, when that's what's happening in Georgia 7. Georgia 7 probably isn't lost to Republicans, but it's going to be a very difficult district to get back. And it's indicative of what is happening, not just in Georgia, but other areas in the South. Tennessee is still a red state, but we do see some signs of that typical, you know, one blue district in Tennessee beginning to branch out, because Republican governors, like I said, they love to bring in the business. Ducey did this in Arizona years before that. Other governors, even Jan Brewer, did it. And what they did, basically, Arizona, specifically Apache County, began to get more and more blue because of the companies that they are bringing in there. We were actually just there a little bit ago talking about the industry that is coming into Arizona. And that does not bode well for Republicans. It just doesn't. It's a more professional class.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Rich, did your polling, was it commensurate with the election results?
Yeah, so we had Biden a little bit stronger in Minnesota than where he panned out. We were within the sampling error in every single state, which is good. But we had Joe Biden, we overestimated him a little bit in Minnesota, about 9.5 points. He won by about 7 and a little over 7. Ohio, we took off the table in September. We told everybody we pulled for the Epoch Times and we pulled for ourselves. Ohio was never close. Iowa got a little close, relatively speaking, in late August and early September, but that was always a blowout too. So we had anywhere between a Trump +6 and +10 in both of those states pretty consistently. So we took them off the table in October and they were pointless to poll. In Pennsylvania, we did favor Trump by a little bit, and by a little bit, I mean a little, 1 point, but rounded up. But again, very close election. So, you know, we're still pretty happy with that. The one state where Arizona is the one where we had Trump by about 2 points, as you guys know, Biden took that state, but he took it by 0.2 percentage points. So very close in every state within the sampling era. However, you know, with Wisconsin, that's another one. We overestimated Biden by about a point in Wisconsin, and we overestimated Biden in Michigan by similarly about a point.
Some of the issues of this election are going to be with us a long time, and particularly how the elections were handled. And you've spoken quite vocally about election integrity reform. What do you mean by that? What were you seeing in your data and your polling that we need to really closely look at if we want to go forward and have confidence in the system?
Right. So this is what I would say, and I'm not a believer in coincidences, right? So this is what I would say I have a hard time swallowing and getting past. We were just going over some of those states. In those six states where they basically used COVID, and they tried this everywhere, and they got it everywhere, but the battleground states that were key to Biden's victory, they used COVID as a predicate to put a moratorium, if you want to call it that, on election integrity laws, which are already on the books. So integrity deadlines, we call them. And that is when it's 8 o'clock, for instance. Let's use Florida as a great example. It's 8 o'clock. The polls are closed. We need to know how many votes you have on election day. Not the actual vote shares, just the total number of votes for each category. How many election day votes do you have? How many in-person early votes do you have? How many absentee ballot votes do you have? Because that removes the suspicion that comes surrounding these ballots that arrive late. And in Florida, we really learned the hard way, right? We had the problem with Bush v. Gore in 2000, and we didn't want to make fools of ourselves again. So the reform we did in Florida was bipartisan, yet we always had the same two offenders, Linda and Brenda in Palm and in Broward. and they consistently came up with these excuses as to why, you know, we're past the deadline, but there's 35,000 votes underneath a truck somewhere. Who knows, right? That's what they would do. And this time, Governor DeSantis replacing them basically was able to conduct a decent election. In Ohio, you're not allowed to handle those votes until a certain time. Everybody's different, but they still know how many votes there are. And any votes that arrive after that deadline, it's just tough. It's too late, right? And that's why we call them integrity deadlines, because if there aren't deadlines, then there's no end to the flow. And nobody knows where these ballots are coming from. You start to lose chain of command. And then really, I put up the bulletin, this 3-point bulletin on our show, because this is really what they did. The first point was that they wanted to rapidly expand the number of ballots that were out and about in the electorate. So everyone got either a ballot unsolicited or ballot requests unsolicited. And we were getting images from all over the country. Somebody got 6 ballot requests. Somebody got 4 ballot. What that was really a display of how dirty our voter rolls are. And this is why we have these integrity laws. People have to understand that the state does not catch up. It is not instantaneous. Those people were getting ballots and ballot requests for people who no longer lived at their address, but at one time did. Even dead people. That happens. All right. So this is why we don't, in Florida, it is almost an inherent safeguard that we don't allow that. You must request a ballot before it gets sent out. And many other states were like that. Why? Because dead people don't request ballots, right? Because you're not going to request a ballot for a certain address if you've been long gone. And then the second thing they wanted to do was remove the verification procedures for counting these votes once they expanded that pool. And they did that successfully in these 6 states. And these 6 states are the ones where we saw Biden just get just enough votes to overtake the president, the former president, in said state. So whether it was Wisconsin at 3:40 a.m. or it was Georgia, you know, the next day, or Pennsylvania 48 hours later, it was just enough to get them over the line. And they did so without any meaningful verification procedure. We're forced to believe that these people who have horrible reputations, let's just be real, they do, that they went through this thoroughly and they carefully matched these signatures. I don't buy it. I don't buy it because I've been around elections entirely way too long. And because there is no honest explanation for the changes that they were requesting and the changes that they got. And then that third bullet point is somebody had to go and get those ballots once retrieved. Some harvesting operation of some kind. And we saw that multiple venues around the country, multiple vehicles really around the country, they use drop boxes, they use ballot harvesters, they use the U.S. Postal Service. So this was, I call it a quasi-election. We've mm-hmm. never conducted elections like this. The system is not set up for it. States are not set up for it. And it was an intentional quagmire.
Right. Will they correct this going forward?
That's the million-dollar question. Right now, Democrats, their very first bill is to make all of this permanent.
Mm-hmm. It really, Rich, this is what I don't understand. Every single day in this country, millions, if not billions, of dollars, treasury stocks are traded online. And there is a way to verify that. People trust that. What do you think it's going to take to make it a trustful product election? I think the only way we can do it is securely over the internet, but there's got to be a will. We have the way, but there's got to be a will to do it, because if we can do it financially, it should not be as hard to do it electorally.
I couldn't agree more. We do have the means to do so. Even with signature verification is archaic, right? We could use fingerprints just like we do with our iPhone. I mean, if we can have Apple, make it so it protects our identity every time we log into our phone, we certainly can have the same kind of procedure in place when we go to vote. It is also a matter of will. When we poll this, I was a little bit shocked. It shows we have a lot of work to do. The most trusted form of voting was paper ballots, which is fine, but the internet was not very trusted. And that's, I think, to some extent, a shame because, you know, I'm a veteran. And when I sign into my vets.gov or whatever, I'm, you know, the DOD, any kind of DOD website, the ID verification is extensive and it's credible, right? So, and it goes a little bit more than signing into your Google account, but we are talking about the sacred right to vote and the sacred right to choose your own representation. So I don't know what else in the world would be more important than to make sure that we're getting that correct. If it's that important to be able to log into your iPhone or your Android, then it is, then it should be at least given, you know, the same consideration when it goes to something as important as choosing a president or an elected leader of any office.
You're so right, Rich. I think we're going to have to leave it there. Producers are signaling me that we all have to move on. Hopefully you will join us again, because I do want to talk with you down the road about election integrity and what people and groups are doing going forward to make those assurances happening. Richard Barris, it's so great to talk to you while in person on the internet. People's Pundit, that is at peoples_pundit.com.
Ellen, one minute. What? Where can we find your YouTube video? It's getting harder to find. The last one I found was on covering the Georgia election. Have you had one recently, or what's going on there?
Yeah, we've been doing a lot on locals because we have gotten some, you know, threatening emails from YouTube. We're going back on now, and it really is what it is. So if YouTube has a problem with what I say, then it looks like I'll just end up on my locals page, which is peoplespundit.locals.com. And if that's the way it's going to be, fine. But we were kind of setting up a backup on locals because we saw the handwriting on the wall. So YouTube was sending us the emails, you know, stop talking about election integrity, stop talking about this, stop talking about that. I mean, it's getting ridiculous. But I am going back on. We're going to have that show actually inside the numbers. We'll be back. It's just we were making sure that we had a backup plan before we went this way. Everybody wasn't taken off guard if in the event they choose to remove you. So it happened before on Twitter, and we want to have a place where people can come and, hey, what happened? And we can reconnect with our followers and our community. So that's where we're going to be primarily, but it'll always still be on YouTube once we get kicking, which is today, in fact.
Oh, good.
Okay, good.
We understand your pain. We have just been talking about how what's old is new again. AM, FM radio. Nobody can take our signal away from us. So you can find us online, but you can also just tune in and get us. We're going to keep speaking the truth to power. That's for sure.
Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it. I'd love to do it again.
Great.
Oh, that's great.
Rich Barris. He's a great guest. You got to watch his show Inside the Numbers too.
Ellen, what he has to say is so important. The reason why we have to be able to transfer power with confidence and trust. The fall of the Roman Empire really came down to they could no longer transfer power. I mean, there were a lot of elements, and it's always overly simplistic to attribute one cause, but that was a factor in why the Roman Empire couldn't go on, because they could not successfully transfer power. And I'm not equating the United States to the Roman Empire.
Well, many have,
I know, and I think a lot of people want to, but we have to be able to transfer this power in a way that whoever wins, wins with confidence, whoever loses, loses with grace and confidence, and we can go about the business of America. And that is so important. So a young man like Richard Barris is really kind of a beacon in the dark right now.
Really, he is. And I think it's something for us all. We have to be able to find the truth and whatever task that we're doing. I think, and he was a real good example. He's a numbers guy. He likes numbers. He likes diving into data. And he saw and he was able to take what skill he has, and he's sharing it with the world and saying, we can do better. And I think that that's something we all have to do. And you make a great point about confidence in elections. We didn't have it this time, and we better get it together, or we're going to be in worse times rather than better times here.
I think so. I think winners and losers have a vested interest and having the confidence that they belong to that office, that they were voted into that office, because the problem is now, and this has been for the past 20 years. This is not new, Ellen. This is a 20-year cycle of who actually won the election. It had started with the hanging chads. Yeah. And Florida has become exemplary. Alabama is actually exemplary. But you have state secretaries, elected state secretaries, that have made it their mission, their dedication to ensure election integrity that goes beyond partisanship.
Amen. So true. Well, Michelle, I don't know if we'll solve it today, but we all got to put our heads together to solve this problem. So, Michelle, stay strong there. In For Michelle McAloon, I'm Ellen Taylor, producer Mike Romano. You've been listening to Convergence here, a product of Archangel Media.